This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services, Wednesday, March 12th, 2003, and it is public hearing on House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. A few just little housekeeping items, and that is if there's anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, would you please make sure that it's turned off so that it won't interrupt the proceedings? And if you have written testimony, if you would hand it to Ryan there on the side of the aisle, then he will pass it out to the members of the panel. And we have a number of people who have signed up to testify, and so I would appreciate it if you would limit your marks to 5 minutes. And Sheila Baker, who's my staff, legislative fiscal staff, will kind of serve as my timekeeper today. So so if she gives me the signal, then, you know, it's time. With that, Bob, you're the...
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bob Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. I've asked to be passed out to you a statement which the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops adopted in November. And the reason I submit this statement to you is I think it has some very relevant language about government that might be informative as we begin this deliberations in terms of how we deal with limited state resources and vulnerable people. The statement talks about the responsibilities of government, a means to do together what we cannot accomplish on our own. In the Catholic tradition, government has a positive role because of its responsibility to serve the common good, provide a safety net for the vulnerable, and help overcome discrimination and ensure equal opportunity for all. Government has inescapable responsibilities toward those who are poor and vulnerable to ensure their rights and defend their dignity. Government action is necessary to help overcome structures of injustice and misuse of power and to address problems beyond the reach of individual and community efforts. Government must act when these other institutions fall short in defending the weak and protecting human life and human rights. In preparation for this hearing and for an article that I've written for a publication, I surveyed Catholic social service agencies to see how they were experiencing the cutbacks in state human services programs and also how they were being impacted. And this is just a brief overview of that survey. We heard from Father Mike Maslowski as you were going through the levels 10 through 14 cuts, and they had initially surveyed 55 potential placements in St. Anthony's Village in southeast Portland and Assumption Village in north Portland that might have been impacted by those level 10 through 14 proposed cuts. I know you restored funding for levels 10 and 11. The people who were not protected are being reclassified, so we don't know at this point what the final results were. But people were impacted, and the anxiety and stress that that caused was quite significant for the patients, their families, the administrators, the staff, prospective residents, etc. I surveyed the Office of People with Disabilities for the Archdiocese of Portland, and this is what we got from Dorothy Coughlin, the director. She received a number of contacts. I just want to share a couple with you. A medical foster mother who cares for four medically fragile infants will have their service funds reduced each month. Quote, before the cuts, I could barely cover expenses. To hire quality care support, you have to pay at least $8 an hour. Who will come for $4 an hour? All of the medical foster parents I know are in the same situation. The other ones deal with disabilities, and I know that budget will come before you later. But Dorothy says, we have reached crisis level. The human cost is too great. When the burden of balancing budgets is borne by those most vulnerable in our community, not only does the resulting crisis in human lives create even more critical needs, but our state tragically fails the test of faithful stewardship of the common good, the measure of our care for those most vulnerable among us. As we focused on the children and adult and families portion of the Department of Human Services budget, we looked at food stamps and ask that the effort and the outreach in food stamps, given Oregon's placement as the state with the highest hunger rate in the country, be sustained and maintained, if not improved. When we looked at temporary assistance to needy families, the taking of the $5 a month pains us significantly. Last session, I call that the most unconscionable cut. I think that has to stand in tension now with the elimination of general assistance. For the poorest of the poor, those who have less than $50 in resources, and those who are estimated not to be able to work for the next year. We look at the jobs program. The jobs program is intended to help not only move people from welfare to work, but to lift people out of poverty. So we ask that the jobs program be fully reinstated. Employment-related daycare, again, enables people to participate in the blessings of the economy. To increase the copay for employment-related daycare and to reduce the participation of people in employment-related daycare by increasing or by decreasing the percentage of poverty that people can be at from 185% to 150% is a decision that we ask to be reversed. In your adoption programs, we ask that those payments for people who have taken adoption of special needs children be restored. There's one particular program that has particular relevance here to us, and that's the Father Taft Foundation. The Father Taft Foundation provides placements for women in crisis pregnancy situations or for women who have had their children, gives them a place to live so that they might be able to get themselves and their children stabilized. Father Taft takes young women in crisis pregnancy situations from around the state. It is not a Salem local program. And the people who refer the women in crisis pregnancy situations to him, in many, if not most instances, are state agencies. Archbishop Vlasny, the Archbishop of Portland, participated in the initial conference kicking off the Campaign for Fairness nearly 2 years ago, April 2001. His comments at that time were, "Poor, vulnerable, and needy persons in our state and society have a special call on our compassion. The budget debate occurring in the Oregon Legislative Assembly this session is not merely about the numbers of financing state government. This public debate is a debate about the morality of state public policy and how we care for the most vulnerable persons in our midst, poor women, children, families, the elderly, and disabled persons. In the spirit of Passover, Holy Week, and Easter, we as a people and state are called to examine our own individual and societal consciences as to how we treat and care for the vulnerable people in our midst and in our care. As has been said in many other settings, we as a people will be judged on how we treat the most vulnerable persons in our society." The list of needs is great. The revenues are limited. When we had our advocacy day here at the Capitol last month, we basically came before the legislature with three essential bullet points or emphasis: maintain the safety net of state programs for vulnerable persons, churches and charities cannot replace government, churches and charities supplement the programs government provides, and we ask you again, as we did last session and as we did during the special sessions, and we will work with you to get to this end, please provide increased resources for state government programs. I thank you very much for your time. I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Bob. Claudia Hutchinson. And what, Karen, is it Karen Quitt?
Yes.
Why don't you come up, and I'll have three come up at a time. And Tricia Berry. Claudia.
Yes, well. Madam Chair, members of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. My name is Claudia Hutchison, for the record. I am the director of the Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center. I have also spent the last 17 years of my career working in the private sector on subcontracts with the state of Oregon to develop and maintain various adoption services. As well, I have served as a foster parent for several of our state's children. I am here today to impress upon you the importance of maintaining adoption services to children and families. The children in state custody who await adoptive homes are truly among our most vulnerable populations. They have lost their family connections, and they are totally dependent on our state for their very sustenance. The very act of terminating parental rights and freeing a child for adoption presupposes our state's commitment to the welfare of these children. National research and a study just recently published by the Child Welfare League of America indicates dire outcomes for our adoptable but not adopted foster children who emancipate from our state's foster care systems. They're very high risk for early pregnancy, incarceration, alcohol and drug abuse, and homelessness, increased financial as well as other costs to the states. Notwithstanding the many excellent foster parents, foster care cannot provide the same emotional, financial, or fiscal security as permanent family membership. Our state has built a nationally recognized adoption program with components that recruit adoptive parents and provide follow-up services. One such very successful program is the Special Needs Adoption Coalition, which is a partnership of many of our state's adoption private adoption agencies that work with the state to train adoptive families and to place children with them. We must continue to fund programs such as these that so successfully move children out of state custody and into the permanent families where they belong. A strong child protection service program is futile without a strong component adoption program. For the children we remove from families so troubled that termination of parental rights is the outcome, adoptive families are the best hopes of breaking the generational cycles of abuse and neglect. Adoption makes good sense economically as well as socially and psychologically. Adoption is a prevention program. It is always less expensive to build and support strong families than it is to build more prisons, more treatment centers, more institutions. When competent, skillful families come forth to adopt our hurt, damaged, and very challenging children, we need to have programs and staff readily available to work with them on a timely basis towards adoption and services to ensure the stability of those adoptive placements. Oregon's commitment to the child's welfare does not end when an adoption placement is made. Adoptive families need services that ensure their success: mental health services, educational services, parent training services, respite care, and financial support to assist the extraordinary special needs of so many of our state's children. An example of a cost-effective post-adoption program is the Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center, of which I'm the director. This program is totally funded with federal dollars. It costs the state not one penny, and it provides services statewide in every county to almost 5,000 adoptive families who are parenting upwards of 8,000 minor special needs children. Our program has received national recognition as one of the first statewide post-adoption programs. Several states have modeled their programs after ours. It's a much appreciated, cost-effective program to adoptive families and one of several that needs to be maintained. Secure adoptive families are our children's best hope for healing from traumatic loss and abuse and developing into productive, law-abiding citizens. I urge you to continue support for the Special Needs Adoption Coalition, the Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center, and the number of other statewide programs. Thank you. I'll respond to questions, and I'll leave additional testimony from some adoptive parents who could not be here.
Claudia, how is the Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center funded?
It is totally funded by federal Title II Subset B funds. And my understanding is that those funds come with a mandate to improve adoption services. Along with the Adoption and Safe Families Act that passed several years ago and the presidential initiative to increase the number of placements of adoptive children from the foster care system came a federal mandate for states to develop post-adoption programs, because we know you cannot just recruit more families and place more children. If you do not have the support services and the follow-up services, you will have more placements disrupting and more children coming back into the foster care system.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morrison, then Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
What is your total budget?
$4,086 a year.
Excuse me?
$486,000 a year. I told you it was cost effective.
You can come to work for us.
I hope that's stricken from the record.
Thank you.
Person B.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find your testimony very, very enlightening. Could you possibly give us a written synopsis of that at a later time?
Yes, I have it here.
Thank you.
I'll leave it with you.
Would you, if you have written testimony, give it to Ryan, because then he'll pass it out to the members, and they can follow you as you testify.
Okay.
Thank you. Karen.
Hello. I'm here to address you today as an adoptive parent.
For the record, would you state your name? Thank you.
My name is Karen Quitt, and I am here today to address you as an adoptive parent. I'd also like you to know that I have a master's degree in education. I have had a career that includes mental health services, corrections involving county and federal work release prisoners, a counselor with a group that deals with incest victims and their families, and I've been a foster home certifier for state children. But I am an adoptive parent of an Oregon special needs child. That was in 1980. After the adoption was finalized, the need for professional agency assistance continued, in spite of my benefits of education and experience. Although there were no post-adoption programs at that time, on many occasions I contacted the adoption agency to request information, assistance, and advocacy due to the high needs of my adopted son. My son and I were very fortunate at that time because someone in the adoption agency gave us the time and effort we needed, even though it was not their job to do so. The Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center now provides these and other services for post-adoptive families throughout the state. Some people assume that damaged children are different from other children in the degree of problems they have. This is not so. They are truly different in their capacity to think and respond like other children. Families need to parent these children differently. The accepted ranges of intuitive parenting and ordinary child-related services are often not appropriate. Even though these children may be in therapy, the parents' ability to cope and to receive appropriate and needed support and service continues. Agencies that deal with damaged children have the advice, support, and service ranges to assist families to keep the children in the home. Some of the services my son required in order to remain in my home included special respite, parenting consultations, information on services, support with the schools, and validation that I was doing that what I was doing was appropriate to the situation. Without ongoing agency support, my son would have been totally dependent on the state for ongoing institutional care from a very early age. Please consider carefully the budget issues under consideration. We have seen that underserved families are more likely to have adopted children who become burdens on their schools, mental health systems, and the community at large. As they age, these children are at higher risk for unsafe and unlawful behaviors, costing the community even more as corrections and adult mental health become involved. Please support the systems that are now in place as they serve us well. The Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center, in particular, does not use state monies and performs an invaluable service to adoptive children and their families and to state adoption workers and staff with whom we network and who are part of our, how do I say that? That part was not extemporaneous, is it my thing at the moment, but Orr Park connects with everybody. That is their job, from mental health providers to everyone. So it's an extremely valuable service. I would love to have you ask me questions, because one of the things that people generally don't have a feel for is how different it is to parent these children. When you first become a parent and people tell you you don't know until you get there, well, you can know a certain amount, but you don't know until you get there, do you? You guys have been parents, I bet. These children are even more different. No matter what preparation you get to be an adoptive parent, the damage that's done to these children and the way that they interact with you and the world is so different that people need new sets of skills.
Karen, how old was the child that you adopted when you adopted Five.
He's now 18. He had been in 7 foster homes in a year and a half, and he was scheduled for institutional care. Because of my professional background, a match was made.
Is that the only adoptee that you have, or have you had other?
That was enough.
I mean, you sound so wonderful. I just wondered if there were more.
That was enough. And as a matter of fact, this child was recommended to a single family household because he was so good at triangulation, manipulation, other factors. So, again, even with all the benefits I have of education and career support and connections within the services that are available, I needed support. I needed help. And so do most post-adoptive families.
Thank you. Teresa?
It's Tricia.
Tricia.
I'm Tricia Berry. I'm an adoptive grandmother. And I haven't adopted other kids. I just have the one. He was premature. Part of the difficulties from the prematurity is that he has sensory integration problems. He has gaps in his expressive and receptive language functioning. He cannot punctuate. He cannot do complete sentences all the time. He will depend on a computer for regular writing. His thought processing in terms of grasp of concept is well enough that if he uses a computer, most people can tell what he's saying because they can't decipher the way he spells. It's very phonetic. He witnessed a great deal of verbal and physical abuse between his parents from the time he was 1 to 2. He's my oldest grandchild. With the learning disabilities and the fact that this was pre-verbal, his acting out was very extreme. He was taken by the state when he was 5 years old. He was not adoptable. They wanted to put him in a residential when he was 5. He was showing sexual reactivity from the time he was 2. And he was very marked when he was 5. They had to find a very special foster placement to place him in before I could get him. I got him when he was 7. The state, when I was able to get him, said that they would provide services. They were willing to provide services to help meet the needs to raise this child. He's expensive. But I'm not as expensive, and he's not as expensive as residential is. And he's not as expensive as incarceration is. In the course that I've had him since he was 7, he's had 2 1-year stints in day treatment, one at Waverly and one at Edgefield. He sees a counselor 2 times a month. He sees a psychiatrist 1 time a month. He attends at least 2 groups a year. I've attended numerous parenting groups, usually a couple a year. I've attended 2 or 3 different 6 to 8 hour parenting classes. I've attended classes that have been put out by mental health services, classes that have been put out by OPARC, classes that have been put out by the Oregon Family Support Network, and parenting classes that have been put out by the wraparound sessions group in Clackamas County that helps coordinate all these services so we're all on the same page. It's very confusing to him if the adults in his sphere are not on the same page in treating him. The first year I had him, my income went down. I'm a single working parent. My income went from $33,000 to $23,000. It takes that much time to go take care of him. It takes that much time to meet his appointments. The second year, I think I was up to $25,000. I lost only a quarter of my income that year, and it's been pretty consistently a quarter since. I work for Legacy Health Systems. They provide a bus pass because he was set up in Clackamas County through Oregon City Schools. And they've done a great job with him, by the way. Absolutely wonderful, wonderful job. And I didn't want to change his services. I moved to Clackamas County, and I bought a car. The cost of the car, the cost of the driving, the difference in driving 50 miles a day to work and back, besides just getting on a bus, which is what I used to do, is significant. We live in the country. We live in the country because his impulsivity is so high that if we lived in town, he would always be out the door trying to find somebody to play with. By living in the country, he stays in. He's able to manage by himself now and take care of himself. He has a terrible time reading social cues. He does not understand other kids, but he always tries to be good. If you really want to understand my child, you can read Ross Green's The Explosive Child. That's my kid. It works very well, and after all the classes I've taken, that's the one that hits the nut right on the top. This last year, just in the last 6 months, we've gone to 49 professional appointments. I've driven 1,024 miles to those appointments. I've driven 6,500 miles to work and 2,000 miles just to get into town to shop because we don't live close enough. I can walk anywhere to shop. I've paid $2,200 in respite. My respite is $10 an hour. It's not eight.
Ms. Berry, yes. Is the biological parents involved with your...
They are having visitation now, and I supervise the visits, and that does have some repercussions. We had to stop visits 4 years ago because he was so reactive after the visits that we couldn't maintain them. It's not that the visits went badly, but his internal, because he internalizes, because everything was pre-verbal, the reactivity afterwards made it very difficult for the school personnel to manage him and for me. Frequently they would call me and I would need to come and pick him up from school. They could only maintain him half a day. A lot of times the daycare providers that I had for him could not maintain him. I mean, it's terrible when I'm the respite for the daycare providers. But that's the truth, that frequently I'm the respite for the daycare providers. He's 11 now, and because we do live in the country and because he manages well on his own, he is staying by himself after school till I get home. He's in touch by telephone. He knows where to call for emergencies. One of the things that I want to impress on you is that he makes progress. It's not what most people would call progress. My child looks normal, so most people expect him to act like 11-and-a-half-year-old. Most of his behaviors are still at the 6-, 7-year-old level. But this year is the first year he cried. And he couldn't cry to express tears was a weakness to him. He couldn't recognize anything other than anger. He can recognize anger now. He doesn't punch holes in the wall. He doesn't throw things. He will sit down and in a very loud voice tell me he's upset and what he's upset about, and may not always use nice words saying it, but he's saying it. Every dime you've spent in this child is worth it. Every hour I've missed from work, every hour I've spent with him is worth it. I knew what I was getting into when I adopted him. I've been with him since he was born, and I knew what I was getting into. I have great admiration for people who adopt kids that they don't know what they're getting into. But I did. And I could not make it this last year. The Legacy Foundation paid our rent for 3 months. I had to quit taking the IRA out because we just couldn't afford it. That was a luxury to have an IRA. But I couldn't get the money out of my IRA because I wasn't evicted and I wasn't buying a house. So it still sits there, but I couldn't get the money back. So I don't have the luxury of having an IRA. But I wanted you to know that it's very important. I got a raise this last year because I got a promotion. It was a 20% raise. It was a significant raise. And if you had hit me with this 7.5% loss, before I got that raise, would have been dead in the water.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
No.
Representative Bates.
I'm sorry. I did have a question.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I wasn't quick enough. If you had to sustain a further loss in the program, would you have to give the child back to the state?
It's not a question of whether I would or not. I wouldn't, because I'm his grandma. The question is whether I could figure out a way to maintain, and I would do my damnedest to make sure I did, because I'm committed to him. But that does not say that at some point, even with all we have done, he may not require residential. There's a schizoaffective disorder that runs on his, on my ex-husband's side of the family that my other two children have, and he may show signs of that starting when he hits puberty. He already talks about some things that are relevant that fit that category, but he's not diagnosable as that yet. He has ADHD. He has PTSD. He shows symptoms of ODD, but he is not truly ODD.
One last question. In your mind, if he could have been adopted sooner, it would have made an impact in his case, and was there an opportunity to be adopted sooner?
There was and there wasn't. It depends on how you want to look at it. There were extenuating circumstances. I had some issues with my health at the time, and they were not the... And I also am a victim of sexual abuse with PTSD, and they were not sure I could take him and take care of him. The state wanted to make sure I could manage the child. So they, when he was in foster care for that year and a half, I took him to all his appointments. I took him... to his counseling and psychiatry appointments. I drove clear out to Beaver Creek to get him from southeast Portland for everything that he attended. I went to all his school IEPs. They wanted to make sure I could take care of him. They sent me to multiple classes that the state provides for training to show that I could take care of him. They wanted to know that my commitment was there and that I wouldn't wake up in the night and kill him sometime. They wanted to know that I truly had had enough counseling, even though I had told them I'd had a great deal of counseling to take care of my issues. But yes, it would have helped.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Lisa Kay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Kay. I know that Mr. Clayton and Gary Hollis are following me on the list.
Well,
and
they can just come right
on up now, too.
Larry Clayton and Laurie Gookins. Is Angela Dobbins?
Gary
Hollis. Gary Hollis? Oh, okay, Gary Hollis, not Laurie.
Thank you. Again, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Lisa Kay. I am an attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I appreciate the opportunity today to speak to you about services for abused and neglected children and their families. At the Juvenile Rights Project, I represent individual children who are involved in the child welfare system. Currently, my clients age in from 4 months old to 19 years old. All of my clients have been abused or neglected by their parents. And as a result of the abuse and neglect, the juvenile court and the Department of Human Services have intervened. The state of Oregon, in addition to an ethical responsibility to these children, has a legal duty to these children. My clients are in the legal custody of the Department of Human Services. That means the state of Oregon is their legal guardian, their legal parent. The state's legal duty to these children is unlike the state's duty to other DHS clients or other Oregon citizens. Additionally, the System of Care Flex funds are part of a settlement agreement that mandates several reforms to the child welfare system. The Department of Human Services entered into this settlement agreement to avoid litigation about the conditions of children in foster care. As an attorney for abused and neglected children, I hear horrible stories of abuse and neglect. Some of these stories my own clients tell me from their own mouths. No child should have to tell such horrible stories, let alone experience them. But these children can also develop wonderful stories of survival and resiliency if they receive appropriate intervention. Flex funds provide individualized services to foster children and their families. The flex funds are a funding stream of last resort. They pay for services that would not otherwise be available. They are prioritized to meet children's safety, permanency, attachment, and well-being needs. I have seen children who have been able to maintain safely in their parents' home Instead of entering foster care with the aid of a parent mentor who helped coach the parent on how to take care of the child, and that parent mentor was paid for by flex funds. I have seen many of my clients overcome the effects of abuse and neglect by receiving flex-funded services. And I will give you some examples. There are children who, whose parents were operating a methamphetamine lab in their house. As a result of this, the house was condemned and destroyed along with all of the children's belongings, all of their toys, all of their clothes. The Department of Human Services, when it took the children into foster care, used flex funds to purchase some clothes for the children and a few toys as well as books that they could have with them because they had absolutely nothing. Sometimes children who enter foster care are not only separated from their parents, they are also separated from their siblings, and brothers and sisters are placed in separate foster homes. This can be extremely emotionally difficult for children. Flex funds have enabled siblings who are separated in foster care to have contact with one another. There are other children who are not in school for years because of abuse and neglect. For one family, children were out collecting cans instead of going to school. The money they collected from the cans was used to pay for food, and unfortunately, a lot of the money went to pay for their mother's alcohol. They entered foster care. They were years behind in school. The school did not provide specialized services for these kids because they did not have learning disabilities. Their deficits were caused by absences. The Department of Human Services used flex funds to purchase tutoring services, and these kids made leaps and bounds, not only in their school achievement, but in their self-esteem and their ability to function. Not only do children who enter foster care need to overcome the effects of abuse and neglect they experience, they also need to be children so they can grow up and be adults. They need to have a childhood. Flex funds have been able to purchase things for kids such as school fees, sporting fees, sporting equipment, graduation supplies, and college application fees. For individual children, these amounts of money used to pay for these things are very, very small. But there's an enormous payoff to these individual children and the state of Oregon by having children be successful. Flex-funded services are often very cost-effective. I know of a child who was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. His diagnoses were a result of significant physical and sexual abuse, in addition to watching his mother prostitute herself. He was able to leave residential treatment and successfully enter long-term foster care with the aid of a flex-funded supporting mentor coach for him, a skill trainer. The cost of foster care and the skill trainer was significantly less than a $250 to $300 per day residential treatment placement. Sometimes flex-funded services pay for things that are court-ordered. The juvenile court will order the Department of Human Services to offer the parents services to ameliorate their conditions, which resulted in the children being taken away from them. As a result of the flex funds no longer being available, kids are in limbo. Their parents aren't able to participate in services because those services aren't available, and they're also not able to move to a permanency option because in order to move to a permanency option, the DHS has to show that they made those efforts. The Adoption and Safe Families Act was enacted to eliminate children being in limbo and being in foster care without a plan of return home or a different permanent plan. I think that there is a significant potential loss of federal funds as a result of the loss of flex-funded services. As I believe the committee knows, House Bill 5100 eliminated the entire system of care program, which included flex funds for the rest of the biennium. I have a client who was able to leave after he spent years in residential treatment and expensive group homes and was finally able to go home. He's very, very excited about being able to return to the care of his parents and to be able to live with his siblings again. The Department of Human Services identified a resource that would meet his safety, permanency, and attachment needs and be able to help keep him in this home.
Continue, but wrap up, please.
Thank you. Because the flex funds were eliminated, the Department of Human Services is not able to pay for this service. Instead, the caseworker said, I guess we'll just have to keep our fingers crossed. This finger crossing has replaced a system, an entire system that meets the safety, permanency, attachment, and well-being needs of abused and neglected children in Oregon. This finger crossing keeps me up at night sometimes, and it should do the same for all of you. I am grateful that there is some money in the system of care budget for the 03-05 biennium. However, the money that's in that budget is a fraction of what the need is and a fraction of what previous budgets were. The budget for the current biennium is less than a fourth of what the 01-03 budget was, and the 01-03 budget was cut by one-third from the 99-01 budget.
Are you going to give us the written testimony?
I'm almost done. I don't have written testimony, but I can give that to you. I am available to answer any questions. I'm, again, grateful that there is some money in the budget, but it's not enough, and I urge you to find additional resources to fill the gap for these very vulnerable children.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We really do need that in writing.
Lisa, could you give us a copy of your notes?
I can't. Okay. I'm not going to be able to do that today, but okay. I can certainly do
it later.
I think
it would be helpful.
Okay. Thank you.
Larry Clayton.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you first for allowing me to be here today. As stated earlier, I am at Memory Foster Group Home. I've been a foster parent now going on 20-something years, 24 years. However, group home provider for the last 5.5, 6 years. My being here today is to hope that monies can be reinstated based on just the experiences that I'm dealing with personally with the boys in my home. I presently have 6 boys, 5 who are group home, 1 who is a foster child. The one I'd like to talk about is my foster child. He is graduating this year without flex funds. I don't believe we would have gotten this far, but he's graduating a senior at Cleveland High School. He entered Cleveland as a 9th grader coming out of an alternative school called Serendipity. That particular school gave him no chance, no hope, nothing for his future. Stephen ended his 11th grade year last year with a 3.0 on a modified diploma. This, I believe, helped Stephen where he's at because of the flex funds. Stephen was able to participate in different activities that encouraged his first attendance at school and wanting to go further. He plans on going into the Coast Guard when he graduates this June. He's just one of many of the young people that I deal with that where these funds assist. For Stephen, he got a chance to travel with his high school choir. He's a fourth-year varsity wrestler, fourth-year varsity football, third-year varsity choir. He was able to do a lot of this, once again, because of my phone call to DHS saying, you know, I can put in so much, but I really need this help because this kid needs to have the same experiences as the kids he's in school with. This is what made the difference. I think had those funds not been there, I would have had to say, sorry, bud, this is going to be a tough one. I believe you want to win a different route. One thing kids will do, and I, regardless of who they are, they do well when their needs are met. In this case, his needs in the area of additional services and resources was being met, and what he has done through that is met the challenge. I have the same story with other boys in my home. All the boys in my home have suffered abuses. 3 of the boys in my home do not have parents alive any longer, and the parents that are alive, we have no idea where they're at. So they don't have someone that they can turn to where some kids turn to their parents. As it was stated earlier, bottom line, I'm a foster parent. My kids call me Papa Larry. But when you get right down to the nitty-gritty of it all, the state is the parent. And the state must understand that we don't neglect our kids. Many of the kids we have in our home are in our home because of neglect and abandonment, abuse, etc. To cut funds that are needed outside of the funds that are given to the homes only puts those kids, your children, your responsibility back into that same situation we just took them out of, and that's neglect and abandonment. Each kid deserves the right, obviously, to feel safe. Each kid deserves the right to know that his needs, regardless of what those needs are going to be met. Yes, we look at sports as activities, but I also look at tutorial programs, mentorships. These funds assist these kids in being able to get where they're at. So I tend to be somewhat dramatic in my plea, but I believe in every one of the kids that I work with. And, hey, I will come up with a way to make sure that these successes happen. Experiences of success is the only thing that allows kids to change. Once they experience success, you can trickle down a little bit of the financial and resources, but we're not there yet. And so to cut those funds when we're already on a limited budget as it is, the group homes and foster homes took a hit. At first, I said, you know, no big thing. I'm going to be a foster parent regardless of what the amount is. But I didn't think it would be affecting the home. But yes, it does when you look at six kids and the things you want to do for them. Before, I was able to say, yeah, when you graduate, we're going to do this. Now I say, well, you know, we need to hold off on that thought. Let's look at some other ideas. Well, I don't want to do that. If a kid has a goal when he comes to my home, he's going to meet that goal. If it means we need to look at ways of bringing in additional funding to keep these programs, not just at my home, but in the other group homes and foster homes, because, once again, they're not our kids. These are kids that others have abandoned. Now, they're my boys. I'll tell everybody they're my boys because that's how I parent them. But when I look at it and the water is clear, they are the state's children. And just like each and every one of you that have children or have parented children, you want the best for your child, and you'll do anything that you can within reason, within legal limits, to make sure that occurs. Well, that's what I've done with the Clayton House group home, make sure it happens. But without those flex funds, it puts a strain upon the home.
Mr. Clayton, I just want to personally say to thank you and all the other foster parents in this state who open up their homes and their heart to take the children that we're talking about. Again, I understand that it's not an easy task, and I also understand that you know, you're not getting a nice little newborn without problems. Mm-hmm. And I just want to personally say thank you to the host of citizens in this state who have stepped up to open up both their hearts and their homes to help these young lives. And I just had to say that for the record, because I used to be in Children's Services Division a lot of years ago, and I understand the role of the foster parents, and I was involved in establishing group homes, so I fully can identify with some of the things that you're saying, and I just had to say thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Shield, did you have your hand up? Senator Corley.
Oh, thank you very much. I just wanted, Madam Chair, to say hello to Mr. Clayton, Larry. God bless you for who you are and what you do. You're an angel, as are the other folks who presented before you. That's how I think of what you do and how you serve.
And now young Gary Hollis, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Gary Hollis, and I'm a foster child, and I'm currently in Larry Clayton's home. And I'm just here to talk about, like, how the Flex Funds has helped me and most other foster kids or group home children on, like, on things that they need in their lives, like school supplies and or like letterman's jackets if they go into sports and things like that. And I'm not gonna talk really long or anything, because a lot of what you said, and I don't want to be repetitive.
How old are you?
I'm 16.
And what school are you attending?
I currently go to Cleveland High School.
Cleveland High School. And after you graduate from Cleveland, what would you like to do?
I'm planning on going to college. And
an Oregon college, I hope.
Yeah, an Oregon college. And I'm currently in business classes, and Flex Funds has helped me through that. By, like, field trips that we go on, they cost a lot of money. And I know that a lot of other classes, like Up Close Government, is, like, they have, it costs, I think, $1,200 to go to Washington, D.C. And I was wanting to take that class tomorrow, or not tomorrow, next year. Sorry. But if I was wanting to take that class next year, it would, that's how much it would cost. And Flex Funds, I know, would help with that if we're in place. But, like, other things that I know I needed money for, like sports, it doesn't cost as much for me as it does for kids that are not in foster care, but it still costs money. And it costs money for, like, shoes and, like, equipment that I would need for stuff like that.
Since you said that you wanted to go into business to be an entrepreneur, I'm assuming that you like math.
Yes, I do. I like math.
You have a couple of individuals on this panel who I own a small business, and Senator Morse is a very good businessman, and I know that math is central to what we learn to do. And just talking about Oregon schools, we've got some great ones that have that. I'm fond of OSU, by the way.
At Cleveland, we run a business program. We have a Cleveland mall, and it costs money, and we learn how to do that. But it also costs money for us if we wanted to take different kinds of classes, like accounting. It costs like $25 for that class, and then for business systems and management and marketing principle classes, I know those cost money. And Flex Funds helps a lot with that, because I know if I didn't have Flex Funds for that purpose, then I wouldn't be doing as well as I am now in that class.
Well, I want to thank you for coming today. And I want to, I think all of us here appreciate your testimony, and we encourage you to continue to do what you're doing. And, I personally would like to hear from you when you get ready to enroll in college. Let me know how you're doing. And, so often we hear from individuals, but we, they come in and talk to us, and we don't hear from them later. So if you could, would you let me know how you're doing?
I'll make sure I do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Got a question?
Oh, Representative Bates. Question.
I'm sorry. You're that close to getting out of here.
He's heading up to track practice.
Yeah. That's okay.
You see those togs?
Yeah.
I mean,
I got to figure it out here.
This kid's quick. Looking good.
Flex funds, right?
No, dad's funds.
No, dad's funds. Well, that's another form of flex funds, then. Well, first, I'd like to, of course, recruit you to the University of Oregon and make you a duck, not a beaver.
No,
but
beaver.
We can argue that point later. I'm going to ask a couple of personal questions, and if you feel uncomfortable answering them, I'd ask you not to answer them. But I just wanted to get kind of a feel. I learn more about these agencies and what the agencies do from the people who are in the programs than anybody else. How long have you been in foster care?
I've been in foster care for approximately 10 years.
How many foster homes have you been in?
Lost count.
How long have you been in your present home?
Going on 7 years.
7 years. So this has been a stable home for you then?
Yes.
I think that's all I wanted to know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck. Look forward to seeing you in green and gold.
I'm already in green and gold at Cleveland. Hoping you stay.
If you're sure you don't want to be a politician, you can come right up here with the rest of us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I get into this? PSU Vikings. Thank you.
Laurie Goodkins and Angela Dobbins.
Good
Madam Chair, I'm just sitting up here as a courtesy to these young women.
That's fine, Lisa.
Thank you.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lori Guggins, and I'm 15 years old and currently a freshman at Centennial Learning Center. Right now I have straight A's, and I plan on going to college and then to law school because I feel that it's important to help people out since you know what they went through, because I've gone through a lot, basically. Flex Funds have helped me out by paying for plane tickets to go see my family down in California, and at least three times a year I go down to Washington to see my grandmother. And it's really important to me because my mom passed away May 3rd of 2001, and she's on my mom's side of the family, so we get to go through photo albums and all that stuff. And so the Greyhound ticket, it doesn't cost that much, but it always helps to have the money to go down there whenever you need to. And I feel that the Flex Fund is an enormous loss to the foster care system since it's been taken away, because there's so many kids out there that don't have families, and they have to have a mentor or something. And it's hard for them, because I know, because I didn't really have a family when I first went into foster care, because I hadn't seen my brother for like 8 years, so I was basically alone.
And where was your brother?
My brothers, I actually didn't know where they were, because I'm not with my dad. I haven't talked to him since I was like three, but because
So you were separated.
Yeah, and then Christmas of 2000, I ran into all of them. I called them up and got a hold of them. And Flex Funds have also helped make arrangements so I could have visits with my mom before she died, because I've been in foster care for 4 years now. And
what school are you planning to attend when you graduate?
I'm not exactly sure yet. I think Oregon State University, but I'm not too sure.
I think it's because you're the chair. Jesus.
Let's knock it off.
And then I probably want to go to Lewis and Clark Law School after I graduate from there. And if I don't become a lawyer, I want to become a forensic person. I think that'd be kind of cool to do.
Really?
Yeah. I've had two internships recently. Right now I'm currently working at Southeast Portland Animal Hospital because I love animals and stuff. So that way I get one work learning experience there. I've also been a kindergarten teacher for my last internship. And I taught 8 little kindergarten boys, and they were just wonderful. But I need 2 work learning experiences before I graduate. And, yeah, so I was doing really good with that. So I think if I was a lawyer, I might be able to help out with, like, kids like that, because there was one kid that was in my class, and he was being abused. So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming and talking to us. And I'll ask you the same thing, to write and let me know how you're doing.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angela Dobbins. I'm 17 years. I've been in the care system since I was 13 years old, and I attend Pivot Job Corps right now. I've come to talk about the importance of foster care flex funds. These funds pay for things like graduation materials, camps, mentors, class trips, school sports fees, and other things in life that kids in foster care should not have to worry about. Personally, I have, through the training program that I attend, Job Corps, I don't get to have a graduation ceremony. I don't get any mementos of graduation, and my caseworker was denied flex funds to get me a class ring, which would be the only memento of my childhood that I would have. And that's why I think flex funds are important, because taking away flex funds takes away the normalities of life that foster youth get. They may seem like extras in life, but really they are things that foster kids shouldn't have to worry about getting paid for. Being in state custody means that the little things that make us feel normal in life should be taken care of. They help us adjust to our already disrupted lives that have been disrupted by the state.
Where you said you're at Job Corps? You said Pivotal?
Pivot Job Corps.
Pivot? Where's Pivot?
It's on 20th and Everett in Portland. It's a business clerical training school for women 16 to 24.
So you're going through clerical training?
After that, I plan to attend OSU and
that 2-0.
you line these people up?
I plan to get in there and get my bachelor's in business management.
I did not coach them, honestly.
Yeah, right.
No, I decided to go because that's where my sister goes, and I want to be with family.
Good for you. Good for you. Well, we thank both of you so much for coming and sharing with us, and I do encourage you to let us know how your lives are and to write us. We really do sincerely care what's occurring and what's happening, and so, let us know how things are going and how we can even add that OSU. I'm very pleased. Tom Hogan. OSU. No, I'm just kidding.
Thank you, Chair Winters, and members of the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. My name is Tom Hogan, and I'm here on behalf of the National Association of Social Workers, NASW, the Oregon chapter, and I'm a member of their board of directors. I'm also a social worker in private practice, and I was a caseworker and supervisor for 31 years with the SCF, with Children's Services. So I'm here to support Governor Kulongoski's proposed budget reestablishing the system of care funding for the kids that SCF works with. As a social worker and retired child welfare supervisor, I want you to know that I'm very familiar with the multiple needs and risk factors of the children coming into care. So we have to have every tool that's available in order to work with the families that struggle with these issues. Abuse and neglect are correlated with many negative outcomes for children, which I'm sure that we know. So the system of care reforms, which began in 1995, have given the caseworkers around the state this tool, better tools with which to protect the kids that they work with. The children often have difficulties in daily living, which I think we know, and so require special intervention from schools, mental health, disabilities, and other systems. Their needs, and I think, and this is a key point, cross traditional service categories and categorical funding services. So the system of care flex funds are for the express purpose of purchasing services or goods for which there isn't any other available funding and which directly meets that child's identified needs. DHS workers purchase the service to meet specific cultural, developmental, kinship, and other needs that no other system is designed to address. And we've heard just a few of them in the previous testimony. I want to comment on the NASW standards. For social work case management, specifically Standard 5, which involves advocacy for the client and client resources. And I'm not going to read that. You have that in front of you. But the Oregon chapter is both in the position of advocating for the services and also supporting our members and other social workers who provide that advocacy. Standard 6 involves resource development. And I think that you have that in front of you, too. So the Department of Human Services child welfare caseworkers, though, are more than mere case managers. For the children we're concerned with today, the state is their parent, and caseworkers act as their guardians. In addition to the ethical requirements and practice standards of the social work profession, we really have a moral obligation to do everything in our power to care for these children in ways that their parents haven't or can't. We strive to do much more, though, than keep them alive and healthy. Social workers need to tend to their well-being in the broadest sense in the hope that they can develop the resiliency to overcome the traumas they've suffered. To do so, workers need every tool at their disposal. We need exactly the kind of resources that have been available for the past 8 years through the System of Care Flex Funds so that we have a chance to change the course of the kids' lives. If we help them do these things, then hopefully they can gain some of the kind of skills that you've heard described today and many more. and become productive adults and won't end repeating the cycle of abuse and neglect. I think in addition to the prepared remarks and speaking on behalf of NASW, I can also say that my experience in being with the agency is that we use flex funds when possible and indicated, and certainly within funding limitations. But in many cases, they were the difference between finding a service for a kid that particular kid needed. I also know that in being familiar with the state budget issues, that there are many services and service requests that do come before you, but I would ask you to consider funding the flex funds in the system of care because of the very specific need that it does meet. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and in front of you today, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
Pam Patton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pam Patton. I am Director of Government Relations for Morrison Center Child and Family Services in Multnomah County, and I'm also co-chair of the DHS SDA 2 Child Welfare Advisory Committee, a really long name. It's formerly the System of Care Advisory Committee. I want to talk with you about two areas today, and I will make this brief. That I really feel that the subcommittee needs to pay attention to in looking at the children, adult, and families budget. And the first thing is what you've been hearing about is the importance of restoring at least the partial funding for the system of care. The system of care has changed how child welfare does its business, and it's changed it for the better. We have seen positive outcomes in the transition to a system of care based on strengths of the children and the family. And as you have heard, the availability of flex funds is one of the crucial ingredients to the success of that approach. I could never top the stories that you've heard from these foster parents, group home parents, adopted parents, and especially the young men and young women that you've heard from. I can tell you for over 7 years I've sat on the advisory committee for the system of care in Multnomah County, and I have watched year after year it change how services were delivered to our children and the success that those children have had due to the flex funds. Morrison Center has utilized in the children we serve in outpatient and in our residential and day treatment programs flex funds, which make all the difference in making the turnaround point for these children's lives. So, of course, we are supporting your restoring those partial funds that were cut due to ballot measure 28. Secondly, I think it's really important for this committee to understand the ramifications on the child welfare system of the cuts that were made in the interim e-board to adult alcohol, drug, and mental health services. The child welfare system is already feeling the loss of these services just within the months that it has been in effect. Children are feeling the loss. Parents whose only chance of getting their children back was to get into alcohol and drug treatment or mental health treatment have no access now to these services. There is no medical coverage for them. They're part of the 100,000 adults who were cut from services from the plus category in the Oregon Health Plan. One of the unplanned results of this cut is that is a cost shifting from adults to child welfare system. It means that children will be in the care and the custody of child welfare for a longer period of time, and for some of these children, the state will now raise these children because the parents will never be able to get them reunited due to lack of access to alcohol and drug or mental health treatment. I would like to propose two options for this committee to consider in stopping this cost shifting to child welfare. I would propose reexamining funding for a benefit package for the standard category and add back benefits based on available funds with a focus on A&D and mental health treatment. Or if that is not possible, I would like the committee to look at exploring statutory or waiver changes that would allow the parent or parents of children taken into state custody to stay in the plus category of the Oregon Health Plan while their children is in care of the state. I know you have many difficult decisions that you need to make. There are other budget cuts that have occurred that will have cost-shifting effects on child welfare system. And one I want to mention that is not in the testimony I wrote, but is also a critical area, and that is the cuts that have occurred with the Oregon Youth Authority. 250 youth have been sent back to their communities, let out of the regional facilities because of the cuts to to the Oregon Youth Authority. These children, these youth, will be in our communities, and there will be a shift to someone taking care of these children. It will, if there is no space in our juvenile facilities, they will become a dependency state, a dependency responsibility of the state, and we will see this also shifting a cost to our child welfare system. We already are overburdening our child welfare system, and we are unable to respond to the needs of the kids that we have now. We have too many kids in one foster home. We are already cutting, as you heard, our foster care payment and our special needs payments. All of these are going to be coming down on a system that is not ready to handle that. I think that we do seriously need to take into consideration some of the cost shifting that's going to occur by those cuts. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Is there any questions? Thank you, Pam.
Welcome.
Betsy Hansen and Sharon Barris. Beat it.
Good afternoon, and thank you again for the opportunity of being here. Actually, we hadn't really planned on being here, but we happened to see the schedule, and we were in town. We were over at the Interfaith Advocacy Day, where we were asked to present there. Again, my name is Betsy Hansen, and I represent NAMI of Washington County and NAMI in general. One of the things I wanted to thank you for is I talk to lots of families. I talk to lots of folks who live with mental illness every day from our resource center in Aloha, and I want to thank you for reinstating medications to the Oregon Health Plan standard package, children mental health services. What I would hope to ask I'm running into a lot of people that are on the medical needy program, and I know that was, if I understood it right, was reinstated to folks that are suffering with AIDS. There's a huge population that are lacking medications, outpatient mental health services, due to the medical needy program not being reinstated in full. So I would hope in 0305 you would find a way to possibly do that. Medication coverage, of course, is incredibly important, as you have found out recently with the recent case with the gentleman who did not get his anticonvulsant medication. In fact, I've got the article here, but it was actually a short span of time, I think, that he was waiting for a drug scholarship program, and I have all those numbers for people at my resource center. But that's kind of window of time that we're dealing with where we're losing lives. Medication coverage really does is a very high priority. As I stated over at the Interfaith Advocacy Day, there are some people with mental illness that can live without medication, some types of depression, et cetera. However, in bipolar and schizophrenia, most of the people that I have met, I think it's a large majority that do need those medications to get their lives back. So we do continue, NAMI continues to feel that that is very important. And an example of something that this gal over here referred to, brought back a memory for me, is the flat affect of my son when he came home from college 4 years ago. that flat affect continued for about a year and a half. And then I finally saw him smile again. He's 23 years old. Part of the reason I think that has happened is because he is on medication. He's actually quite, don't like the use of the term, high functioning. However, he lives independently, et cetera. Part of the problems with some of these cuts that have had devastating effects affect the people that are left behind. And the health of my son at this point is a little shaky, and I'm going to pass to my friend Sharon here, who can tell you why.
I'm giving a testimony. Thank you for listening to me today.
Could you give your name for the record?
Sharon Bemis. I think you were passed out a flyer. The young lady on the front is my daughter. She lost her battle with schizophrenia February 7th. She took an overdose of medications. That was a week after the defeat of Measure 28. And she lost all of her general assistance. She had just moved into her own apartment. And she was so excited about having the freedom of having her own place to live. And this was just swept away from her in a minute of one vote for Measure 28 defeated. She tried a couple times to register to vote, and both times it was sent back to her because of one reason or another. It was the address was wrong or something. And thank you. She was very stressed, and she knew that if she lost her money, it might take away her livelihood, her hopes, her dreams. And the stress caused the voices, which are associated with schizophrenia. I don't know how many of you saw Beautiful Mind. Okay. In that movie, what is different from John Nash is that her voices, her reality that she knew, were not very nice. They were very harsh and very mean, and they told her that she was no good and that she'd just kill herself. And unfortunately, those voices won. This case is a matter of life and death. You know, we've had cases, and it was in the paper not too long ago, about a gentleman who shot himself in the Salem Hospital just last week because he learned that he was losing his medical benefits. And in that same article, they indicated there were five other people who had lost their lives since Measure 28. I called the Department Investigations and Training to find out if my daughter was on that list, and she was not. She was not being investigated. So that's one more. How many more are there that aren't being investigated? I ask, please, take responsibility. Take responsibility for these vulnerable people. Do the right thing. On behalf of my daughter, I'm here today because I'm begging of you, take note. Now, we were talking at the interfaith. God's watching. God's watching all of us. Mm-hmm. And he's going to see if we're going to do the right thing. Because of her death, it's given me making me a little more bold than I may have been. And I don't know the ins and outs. I'm not a politician. But I kind of started with the top, and I'm coming down. And I just recently sent President George Bush a letter asking him for help here in Oregon. This is a state of emergency. People are dying here. They're going into hospitals. You know, we can't wait. This needs immediate action. And it's an atrocity to our people and our loved ones. So, in the meantime, on behalf of my daughter, I've set up a fund. It's called Vera's Benefit Relief Fund to try to help others like her with mental illness. In the meantime, we're in crisis with medications, with housing, anything to help them get through this crisis. And it's not much. It's a Band-Aid. Right now, we've only got $5,000 to dispense, and that's not a lot considering how many people have mental illness. But it's something. We're trying to do something. We're trying to take immediate action. And I ask you, please, please, I beg of you, take immediate action. We can't lose any more loved ones.
I want to say something real quick. My son and Farrah were very good friends. He was with her Wednesday and Thursday. I think some of you have seen that story. The next day when we went over to Sharon's, this woman is quite incredible. In the middle of her grief, the day after of her daughter's death, as she and my son Todd were consoling each other, she said she wanted a fund. And I said, I'll make that happen. So that is what we've done. And 2 weeks after the memorial service, we had 5,000. I think she's started something. I hope she's started something. But again, what I want people to remember, as it was mentioned before, nonprofits, funds like this, are basically sort of a Band-Aid. We can't do it all. We need some help. So I was talking to someone regarding going down to legislation and you're going again. But this is the time, this particular situation, and we know you're all working very hard, is obviously when you do need to see the faces of whom it's affecting. So,
go ahead.
I want to just add one more thing. Senator Gordley mentioned at the advocacy today that there is confusion and there is stress on you all. And I talked to Betsy about it, and we are more than willing to come down and help you. All you have to do is ask us. We will help you with any questions, anything, to get this resolved.
Thank you. Thank both of you, and thank you for your courage in coming here to talk to us today.
Thank you.
Jessica Stevens. Teresa Valdez, Debbie Averell, and I think Judy Cooper's with you too?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. My name is Teresa Valdez. And I work for the Department of Human, yes. Formerly Adult and Family Services, I work for the Self-Sufficiency Office in Hillsboro. My title is a program representative, and I'm there to help the workers with the new policy changes and help train them, help work with them. And I'm also a liaison between the workers and the staff. And the clients. One of the things that I've seen a lot of in the last few weeks, as you're going through a lot of stress issues, a lot of frustration, and a lot of how am I supposed to make all of these things happen at this one little time, I see the reduction in staff, therefore the increase in the caseloads that are just tremendously climbing. We've just recently lost quite a few workers. So we have one food stamp worker that speaks Spanish. That's an interesting one. And the frustration on our worker side of trying to meet the daily needs of all the clients coming through with all the needs, trying to get their benefits processed in time. And then at the other side, you see the frustration of brand new clients that have come in that have never, ever been on any kind of assistance before, that have been waiting to the last minute. The embarrassment that they're feeling coming through the door for the first time. How do I meet with all of the needs of my family? And it's such a stressful time to see how everybody, and I get right in the middle of seeing all of these people, and I love my job. It's a very wonderful job. It's, you're afraid now to pick up the phone. You're afraid to what kinds of complaints and things are going to come through the door. We've had a lot of people with the Oregon Health Plan, how it's changed, a lot of people threatening that, well, if I can't get my birth control, we're going to have more children. It's like, no, that isn't the focus that you really want to put on it. And I do thank you that the medication has been extended starting as of the 17th of this month. But it's just a real difficult time, I think, for all of us, trying to figure out how can we service all of these people, how can we meet needs for them with limited staff, there's only 8 hours in a workday, and it's so difficult to meet all of those people coming in. And I'm here on the front lines, and I just came to give you my information, and I don't have any statistics. All I know is that our 40-hour work week. Yes.
You say your front line. Have you had a reduction in your staff on the front line?
On the actual front line, yes. Our office has become integrated. Half of us are at the child welfare side, and half of us are at our enterprise circle. So there has been a reduction based on we're split. We've been mandated to be in two separate locations. So 21 people that were in our office, we're now down to about 10 in our office. It's not... don't look like that.
I am looking like that.
It is because we were mandated to integrate. So,
well, but
one side,
the integration was not to reduce
right
your numbers.
Right.
That's why I ask you the question.
Right. Well, and that's because they were mandated to. They only had enough room in this area to put so many of our workers.
Moved.
They moved. Half of us have moved. So,
okay.
Right. Half of us are there. So with that reduction of people, we're having to say you need to be sending people to the child welfare office. That's where our TANF workers are. But we're still mandated to maintain that amount of clientele that walk through the door.
So your overall numbers have not reduced?
Our number-wise have not reduced, no.
You're
but we're,
give me a
we're moved. Well, that's what we go through daily. So it isn't that physically the numbers have left. It's just that they're in two separate locations.
Okay.
So, but the amount of clients have almost tripled coming through our door, and we don't have enough people to take care of all of the people coming through to meet the needs.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Madam Chairman. My name is Judy Cooper, members of the committee. I am a child welfare worker working, again, on the front lines in Hillsboro, Oregon. So what that means is that I have a caseload of about 25 families, which translates to 300 people that I need to be in relationship with during the life of those cases. The 300 people include attorneys, judges, foster parents, doctors, therapists, boyfriends, parents, grandparents, a huge range of people, because each case that I deal with has about 15 people who are very actively interested in the children. And I am, on behalf of the state of Oregon, I am the legal parent for 37 children right now. And that means that I'm involved in every aspect of those children's lives, from the little boy Dylan who eats his own feces, to the 7-year-old Nerys, who has already in the first grade been suspended 3 times so far from school, to the 13-year-old boy David, who has threatened to kill his mother, We have an incredible range of things going on in the lives of those children. And it's my job on behalf of the state to see that those kids get what they need while they are the state's children. And I feel like I'm doing it now with one hand tied behind me because, and you've already heard testimony today about system of care flex funds. Those funds were absolutely essential to our providing what it was that the kids needed. And we've lost those, and we're feeling very, very limited without them. And then the other thing that I do, in addition to being the legal parent for those children, is my role is to work with their parents. So when after the children have been in our custody for the first month or so because they were unsafe at home, then I'm what's called a permanency worker, and I sit down with the parents and I say, okay, we have 10 months for you to turn your life around, and I'm going to help you in every way that I can. You're going to do the work, and it's my goal to do what you need to help you do what you need to do in order to get your children back. And again, I'm having serious limitations in being able to do that. The majority of the families that we work with, as I'm sure you know, are meth addicts. And so now what we have is a situation where we have say to these families, you have to get into recovery, you have to go into treatment, you have to begin your process of recovery, and but you know, we don't have any treatment services for you. So that's happening right now. It's today's crisis, and it's very, very serious.
Judy, how many of your 25 cases are currently that you have tried to get either A&D or mental health treatment for, and you're not successful in getting it?
Okay, right now about three that are just immediate. I have some who have finished treatment, and their children have been returned, and we're just working with them during the return process. I have others who I had a mom who was in one night last week who said, I'm desperately trying to get into detox, but nobody will take me. Nobody will take me into treatment. But in her case, we've already decided to terminate her parental rights because you've already heard about the ASPA, the timeline that we have to work with.
And so she was an individual who came in who had a drug-related issue, and you know, with those that come in, termination proceedings, the warning is there when they first come in the door, so she waited until D-Day and then came in.
Actually, we had gone with her through treatment twice, and she had relapsed. And so she's now on her third attempt to get into a treatment program, but the child has been in care for 2 years, and we've got to go to permanency on this child.
Well, for not all of the members on this panel are know about the termination of parental rights and Senator Morris statutorily once the person enters the system, and where there is drug and alcohol involved, the agency is responsible to, one, to attempt to try to address those issues, but also they are required to move towards termination of parental rights. Just so it's statutorily required.
Right, and the federal statute gives us 12 to 15 months to make that determination. Is it safe for these children to go home, or are we going to have to move toward termination of parental rights? Yeah, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
What kind of success ratio do you find in drug and alcohol treatment?
In drug and alcohol treatment, you know, if the treatment program is good, I've had probably 60%. 60% of the people who get through the program and are committed to staying clean and do it over a period of about 2-3 years. That's been my experience.
Follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you find a different ratio for alcohol than for drugs?
I'm trying to think if I know that. I haven't noticed that the ratio is any different. Alcohol. There are fewer people on my caseload who are involved with alcohol addiction, but it's very serious when it gets a hold of somebody.
Thank you.
Judy, I know that in the casework world that there are some facilities that are identified that are more result-oriented than others. So I don't know whether you still have some options of referring your individuals to specific facilities.
You know, I'm in Washington County. A lot of Multnomah County, when they were accepting our folks, a lot of Multnomah County facilities wouldn't take Washington County people. So Washington County people are fairly restricted. We had one inpatient program that we use pretty regularly. Outpatient program through Tualatin Valley Centers, but now, as of March 1st, clients are having to pay $60 a week in order to get into that program, and they don't have it. These are mostly women who, when they work, are qualified for the lowest wage jobs. And they can't do it. They barely keep themselves off the streets. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Averill. I'm here as the rest of these folks are, as part of the Service Employees International Union, Local 503, the Oregon Public Employees Union. I work for the Department of Human Services, again, in child welfare, but my emphasis for many years has been on the other end of the system, the adoptions program. And I came to working in child welfare in 1981 and have worked continuously in our system since that time. I started doing adoption work in approximately 1987. And what I want to talk about is some of the changes I've seen in the children that are being placed for adoption, the kinds of additional support services that were talked about by the Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center folks a little earlier, and the importance of those to maintaining placements for these children that Judy's involved with, whose parental rights are ending up being terminated because they can't provide a safe and stable nurturing environment for their child over the long haul. It has been the policy of the agency for many years that we don't even go to a termination of parental rights action unless it is felt that there is a likelihood that we can actually find an adoptive placement for the child, because the state of Oregon, it's not a very good parent, and we would like the children to have other legal parents than us. When I started doing adoptions in 1987, we didn't see the numbers of clients coming in the front door with the drug kinds of things, and so we were not seeing as many children who were very damaged by prenatal exposure. And by witnessing domestic violence, a number of things that we see very commonly now. So what we see is children who from a very young age are, I don't like the word damaged. People say damaged, but they've had such life experiences that the way they act within their world is very different. than from a for a child who's been in a stable, nurturing environment. And Judy mentioned the, you know, the child that eats his own feces. At this, I didn't see those in the 80s. I see them regularly now in the adoptive homes. And we have an emphasis in our system of placing children in relative homes if possible. And many times, as you know, you heard the one grandparent testify earlier, they make a significant lifestyle change to just, you know, grandparents are usually at the point in their life where, you know, they can send the kid home and be grandparents, and they will make the significant sacrifice in order to raise their grandchild. They don't see it as a sacrifice, that's my word. I think they see it as what you do when you take care of family, and what most of us would try to do. But often we're talking about individuals who at this time in life may be on a fixed income. We've seen that the special needs of the children are significant enough that without a lot of services, they can't maintain them. We have been fortunate in Oregon in that we've had a very strong adoption assistance program over the years, and it's grown exponentially since I was first doing this job. But we've never intended to support the kids completely. It's not meant to be room and board and all that. This is to support their particular special needs. And what we did when we took the 7.5% out of the adoption assistance payments is that we put people in situations where they could no longer afford the gas to get the kid to treatment, pay $10 for a respite care provider. And believe me, if you don't have good respite care in a special needs adoption, the adoption is, it can get into really bad trouble. When I was first doing adoption, we had no post-adoption services in place at all. And we used to field those calls. The statement was, you know, once you have a family in the adoption program, they're your client for the rest of the time you work for the agency, because they will continue to call you. And that's true.
Debbie, I'm going to need you to wrap up so I can get to Jessica.
Yeah. At any rate, I want to underscore that the whole system needs to have adequate resources to deal with the kids from the very front end when they're first taken out of an abusive situation, through all of the work that Judy and her colleagues do, and also to assist these wonderful folks, the foster parents and adoptive parents that open their homes and hearts.
Debbie, what percentage of your cases are special needs now?
So I'd say 100% at this 100%? Point. 100%? Yeah. Because even the few newborns that we place for adoption have all been, almost all of them have been prenatally exposed.
Drug affected,
or they bring with them genetic predispositions to mental illness, such as schizophrenia and bipolar disorder.
So we're still talking about the implications of what's changed
right.
in society with
right.
the massive use of
right.
drugs. Thank you. Jessica.
Thank you, Senator Winters, Chair Winters, and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Stevens, and I'm a political organizer with SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. And you've heard from our members who see the work on the front lines and are the faces to the dollar signs that you are dealing with. And we want to thank you for the difficult tasks that you are dealing with in terms of trying to figure out how to fund these invaluable programs with a limited amount of resources. And we just wanted to conclude today to say that we are not only here in this building asking for you to fund these programs, but that in addition we are coming to you with recommendations for solutions to finding revenue. And one of the places that we've discovered is...
I would suggest you talk to the Revenue Committee.
And Chair Winters, thank you. I appreciate that. But I do want to make clear that we are having these discussions with members of the Ways and Means Committee as well as with the Revenue Committee, because we want you, as you take leadership in talking about the importance of these programs, to be able to have information to say we can fund these programs and we need to. And just making cuts isn't good enough for the children of Oregon and for the families of Oregon. And that one of the ways that we can do that is we can look at our tax expenditures and closing some of the loopholes for the tax breaks that we give. We currently give back more in tax breaks than we collect today. And in fact, we only collect approximately...
Because my committee, and I'm going to cut you off because I have some other people, your debate on that issue is with revenue. It doesn't mean that I can't talk to revenue, but that discussion is a revenue over on the House side, which is where that money bill generates, hopefully. But I would implore you to have that conversation over at MAX. I think it's Lane Chatterley's committee. But I need to hear about what's happening in the budget world from those individuals.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I know that you will have an opportunity to vote on whatever tax expenditure proposal comes forward. So we want to make sure to tie the concept of funding the programs with where that revenue can come from.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lynn Hackelman, Dean Longfellow.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Hackelman.
And I have one more person behind you, so to make room for another.
I will say. My name is Lynn Hackelman. I am an adoptive mom of three boys from the state of Oregon.
Bless you.
Thank you. I am also an adoptee myself, my sister and I, from the state of Oregon several years ago. I wanted to talk about post-adoption funds and SOC funds. Without post-adoption funds, we probably would have disrupted our kids. We got our two little guys. They were 2 and 3, 26 homes, already a disrupted adoption under their belt at 2 and 3. We knew they were real damaged when we got them, and they are damaged, extremely wounded. We did not know what it would be like living with it. Urinating all over the house, the rages, the holes in the wall, respite that costs $100 to $150 a day, when you can't take your children on vacation, false allegations of abuse, all of it. My oldest son is now 9. He is in residential treatment. The state is paying $14,000 a month for his care. That's where the SOC funds come in, because SOC funds have been denied. He is not getting services. We'd like to get him an equestrian therapy, neurofeedback, because this child's been in therapy since he was 3 years old. He's gone through the Morrison Center program. He's had outpatient therapy. He's been in residential treatment for 2.5 years now. He went in at 6 years old. Without SOC funds, we cannot get any additional service for him, and hope is quickly diminishing for this little guy. And I made a comment or a note, kind of snide, you know, it's great to see these success stories of these foster kids up here, and wonderful to joke about what college they're going to go to. I worry about what jail my son's going to end up in if he does not get the services. And we're willing to hang with them. We're trying to hang with them. But again, back to post-adoption services. If we don't get that money, you know, I put 8,000 miles on my car last year running my boys to services, physical therapy, occupational therapy, mental health therapy, you name it, IEPs. I cannot work. When we adopted these boys, I anticipated being off work a year. 5 years later, I'm still not able to return to work. I could return to work, but then I'd be giving up on my boys. So, again, I would urge you to... look at those funds. You know, it's a little, well, I guess it's a lot of money up front. Will save a lot of money years down the road and save a life. And I would also remind you of Matthew 25:40, which is my favorite Bible verse. I'll let you look it up.
Thank you. Maybe Dean will give us Matthew.
Yes, he knows it.
Hi, Madam Chairman and subcommittee members. I'm Dean Longfellow. I'm a licensed psychologist. I practice in Newburgh, Oregon. Also work as a supervising psychologist for a residential treatment program, and occasionally they let me teach a class at George Fox University. I'm a graduate of Portland State University. I'm here. A large percentage of my practice is private outpatient practice, and I'm working a lot with adoptive families and foster families. Most of the kids I see are high-risk kids. They're vulnerable. They are difficult to parent and very difficult to treat. I have, of all the people that have talked, I have the easiest job. I work 1 hour a week to maybe 2 hours a week with the kids, and I find it difficult to maintain hope. If I was the only thing that was going for these kids, they would not be making it. What I see when children are successful in their adoptive placement is a surrounding system of care where there's services and support in social work, SOC funds, and the like. It takes all of us. In essence, these kids are in very high risk for needing a lot of future services. They're also at high risk for continuing on the problems that are causing these problems in the first place. And my encouragement, because I know that we're looking at a very, very big budget deficit coming up in July, if cuts have to be made, don't cut on these vulnerable kids.
Thank you very much for coming. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question about your two children.
Yes.
Do you know the cause of their disabilities?
A number of things. Drug and alcohol effects, for one. All three of my boys were prenatally exposed. In my two younger sons that we've had 5 years, 26 moves. My son that's in residential treatment is severely attachment disordered. 26 moves by the time he was 3 years old. He never formed a bond with someone. The state, in part, is responsible. They moved him around. They returned him to his birth mom 6 times that I know of. So that would be primary reasons.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Just a quick clarification.
Sure.
Do your three boys come from the same family?
My two younger ones do. They are full birth siblings. My oldest son is not, no. Different.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Mrs. Lowe, Ellen Lowe.
Chair Winters and members of the committee, in light of the time, I'll try to be short. I'm Ellen Lowe. I'm here today as legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center and the Oregon Food Bank. And both of these organizations really have as their charge serving many of the families that you are addressing in the budget for children, adults, and families. And so we follow these budgets with a considerable amount of interest. I will not go through everything I have prepared for today, but I do wish to address a couple of things. One, in the role that I ended up playing in the Yes on 28 campaign, I frequently heard about the need to restore faith in government, trust in government. And one of the things that has become so clear to me as I have listened to the deliberations on this budget is that in many instances we find ourselves in a position of breaking commitments. And so things that I would suggest might be not honoring public trust if indeed we are forced to proceed with what is in the governor's technical budget. And so I would sincerely hope that you do join some of us in an occasional visit to Hearing Room A, because it is going to be critically important. In my age, we often use the term being penny wise and pound foolish. And the cost shift of some of these things are going to be all of us as Oregonians. And so we do ask that as you deliberate on the other sections that are part of the Department of Human Services, that you look at the implications. I've heard you discuss the relationship between alcohol and drug abuse and the termination of parental rights. And so when you are dealing with those health services, that would be the kind of thing that we would hope that you would look at in relationship to this part of the budget as well. And the other thing that we would note is that as the resources have become so limited, so often in our services to children, it's sort of after the fact, it becomes protective rather than there in early intervention. So we also would ask that you look at the budget for the Commission on Children and Families, and so that perhaps there can be better connection for services to families before they become part of the protective system. We'll be watching you and following you.
I know you will.
And so thank you so much. And we don't envy your task, but we do look for you to help us begin to build more public trust in what Oregon really can be and will be again. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. She's been around this building as long as I have.
Yes.
And we've both become very chronologically advantaged in building, you know. And
yep, and I'll see you at 5 o'clock.
I'll see you at 5. Thank you. Is there any questions of Mrs. Lowe?
Thank you.
If not, we are adjourned, and I will see you tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
What are we doing tomorrow?